Accession number 30505.
General Sir John Mogg, Reel 4. You were giving an active command, General. When was this?
Well, suddenly when I was commanding the battle school, I was sent for by General Brown Wainwright, my divisional commander, and he said, "You've been nagging at me to get overseas and service and everything else into a regular active command. You are going to be second in command of the 9th Thermalite Infantry in the 50th Division." So I sucked my teeth a bit and said, "That's marvellous," and saluted smartly, and then got ready to go to the 9DLI. I could tell you about that. It would take quite a long time, but you were going to ask me another question about it.
Yes, I would like to go back to the whatever changes that war was bringing into the training tactics, the weapons.
Yeah, I think really it was a degree of amount of time we had. Of course, by this time, with everybody in joining up and enlisting, we had masses of soldiers coming in, both in the regular army and in the territorial army. And up to that moment, my whole ambition, really, and wasn't really a great deal higher, was to enjoy myself to the full, and by taking every opportunity to get away from my duties. And everybody seemed to encourage me to do that. In fact, when I came back after being away for 3 weeks, they were slightly surprised to see me. It was really nice. But now the whole thing, the whole emphasis changed, because with new officers and new soldiers coming in who knew nothing, the whole thing now developed on making sure that every single moment of training value was used to the best value. And so your job, as whatever it was, as adjutant, it was just a question of organizing the battalion and making sure the commanding officer's orders got through. But when it became a company commander, then you had 120 men, of which you probably had only about half a dozen, from sort of warrant officers and the odd sergeant or two, and the odd regular soldier who'd come back, who'd left and to come back again, who knew anything at all. And so we had to start from scratch and start really from the basic infantry training. And it was a question of using up every single second. And nobody really had any spare time at all then. I mean, we really did work from 6:30 in the morning till late at night. And
which company did you command?
A Company, to start with. I spent all the time in the 5th Battalion, A Company. And that was my job as the company commander. I was solely responsible for those 120 men and all the stores and equipments and everything that went with it. And the lives of those men, 24 hours a day. And it was fascinating. I had some marvelous people. And, of course, being a war, everybody was on the same side. And it was very much easier to get people to react to that and put the cause across to them, which they did. Very well, and that was marvelous.
Did you find with civilians in effect coming in that there were problems of initiating them into the army?
No, I mean, it's quite extraordinary how good the civilians became very good soldiers. You're in the teaching profession. We had quite a lot of schoolmasters who came in and made very good officers indeed. And though I don't think it made any difference what background they had, you tried to fit in. For instance, if you had somebody who'd been in the transport side of it, he was probably made a driver or something, or you try to fit that background into it. But no, it all seemed to gel together very well.
How is the company organized, General?
Well, you have five officers. It's generally, the company is about 120. You have a company commander, second commander of a company, and three platoon commanders. You have three platoons of 30 men each. And those platoon commanders command 30. Quite often, we found there weren't quite enough platoon commanders to go around, and so you quite often had platoons commanded by sergeants. And that worked just perfectly well.
What was the weapons? How were the weapons distributed?
Well, as I say, in those days, we just got the Bren gun coming in, I think. We had Lewis guns to start with. I was training people. That was in the peacetime days, and then we had the Bren guns coming in. And we had an anti-tank rifle. We had grenades throwers, 2-inch mortars. We had a mortar platoon, 3-inch mortars, anti-tank platoon, carrier platoon, carriers were suddenly coming in. And we were getting all this new equipment and stuff. A whole lot of people who knew absolutely nothing. So we had to start from scratch.
Did these cause you to change tactics from what you had been doing your training?
Oh yes, because very much, because we really, I mean, up till then I hadn't really had any of this equipment to be able to train with. I mean, even as a platoon commander, regular battalion, we hadn't got these things to start with. And everything was pouring in now, on the whole. It took some time after Dunkirk for it all to pour in a way, but...
Were you yourself?
When we were in Northern Ireland, when we went to Northern Ireland, we really were then more or less fully kitted out by the time we got there. So that awful pause from Dunkirk onwards when, you know, we were defending this country with a few rifles, really, that's about all, and a few guns, that's all, in the Air Force. And then suddenly the whole thing built up, and I can't remember what the sort of time factor was, but by the time we got to Northern Ireland, we had practically, well, all the sort of kit that we should have. And we had a whole platoon of carriers, which was quite a lot. The mortars had carriers to carry their mortars in. We had 6-pounder anti-tank guns pulled by jeeps. We had, as I said, Bren guns and 2-inch mortars, which fired both HE and smoke. We had a sniper platoon, trained people in sniping. And it was a full-time job. It really was. And we got better and better and better and better. As I say, having done a 18 months solid, nearly 2 years in Northern Ireland from 1940 to 1943, flat out. In Northern Ireland, we were well trained.
Initially, was the training of a very defensive nature? I'm thinking in terms of defending.
No, we tried awfully hard not to do that, if I can remember rightly. I mean, naturally, obviously, when after Dunkirk, we had it was all defensive because we were putting up the defences along the beaches and defending vulnerable points and bridges. I remember defending, working out the defences for Red Bridge over coming out of Southampton, where I had a company stationed. And it was very much defensive, and putting up wire and building pillboxes and that sort of thing. That's because we reckoned we were going to be invaded at any moment. And gradually, when the invasion side of it, sort of fell away, we started saying, right, the time is going to come when we're going to have to operate in the offensive role, and with any luck, we'll do an invasion into Europe. So we then started doing the... active offensive side of it, and it was much easier to get people excited about the offensive side of it, and patrolling and all that sort of thing came very high onto the level, and movement and that side of it. And so that's what we did from the point of view. Is anything else on the training?
I was just wondering, was there any fixed method of training laid down for offensive that you followed, or was it pretty flexible?
Well, there was, because there was... The great school of infantry and the battle schools all had a systematic way of trying to train you so that you all had the right thing. For instance, the way of giving out orders. There were the various headings that you used to give out orders so that everybody was on the same net over those sort of things. And the battle schools produced the sort of philosophy and the tactics of fire and movement, and you followed those. People went on courses to learn that, then came back to the battalion and passed the knowledge on, ran courses within the battalion. And people who had to fire a mortar went to, they went to NAPA schools on how to use the mortars, came back, and then they ran CADA courses for the NCOs, and then they passed that on right throughout the battalion. That was mortars transport, and there was a... drivers were sent away to learn to drive. MT officers were sent to go and understand all about the combustion engine and to learn how to do the maintenance and that sort of thing. There was a signal school where the radio sets and all that was done at central schools and then brought back to the battalion and then they passed it on. And it's amazing how quickly civilians adapted to this. I mean, and they became... in a lot of cases, very much better than the regular sweat in the end. And they were full of enthusiasm on the whole.
Weapons, were you happy with the weapons? Were there any weapons which you felt weren't quite what you...
From the infantry point of view, I think on the whole we were very happy. I think perhaps from the tank point of view, no, I wouldn't be an expert on that, but I wouldn't have thought so. But, I mean, all these evolved during that period after Dunkirk to when we went across. And when we went across, of course, on D-Day, I reckon we were as well armed as anybody, except perhaps from the point of view of armour. The German tank was really better than the tank that we had. And the German anti-tank gun, the SP anti-tank gun, had a very much longer range than we had. And they were particularly good at concealing themselves. And one small anti-tank crew could hold up an advance for quite a long time until the actual sheer weight of numbers destroyed them. But they were, the German tanks and anti-tank guns were definitely superior to us at that stage.
What was your opinion of the carrier?
Carrier was a marvellous weapon. It really was. And we used them a tremendous amount in Normandy. When we got through the blockage country, of course, you couldn't use them in the blockage country because of the high banks.
What was their role?
The role was movement of fire and movement, quick fire and movement, and also to carry the mortars. They were used for them. But quick patrols, and I mean, two or three battles, we actually had carriers moving forward with the tanks. And it took a crew of people very quickly across bad, rough country, very much more quickly you can go on your flat feet, and you had a certain amount of protection with the carrier.
How were they crewed? What kind of crewing did they have?
Well, you had an officer who was in command. I think it was, I can't remember how many carriers there were. I think it must have been about 9 carriers, I think, in the carrier platoon. And they had the officer and sergeants, corporal, and they had crew in each carrier. And they were mounted with Bren guns and rifles and grenades and 2-inch mortars. And you could put a carrier platoon, say, quickly to occupy a bit of high ground. And you could go straight up there, get out of their carriers. The carriers would move back down behind the hill, and there you've got a carrier platoon holding a bit of ground for you. That's the sort of thing you could use them for.
Can we explore the way in which you use other specialist sections? The mortar platoons, what was the use of the nerves?
Mortar platoon was normally concentrated at home normal routine, although you could use them on occasions with a detachment of one mortar and a team, or even 2 mortars and a team. But normally it was used as a sort of, rather like the gunners had a battery, and you used them to fill in the gaps that the artillery had a defensive fire around your area, or they, if you were doing an attack, certain targets were allocated to the artillery, certain to the air force, and certain targets to the mortars. And there were the 4.2 mortars, which were the bigger ones, which were a separate regiment had 4.2 mortars, like the Cheshire Regiment had machine guns and 4.2 mortars. And they were the sort of supporting arms, the heavy mortars. But our own battalion mortar, 3-inch mortars, they filled in the gaps between the artillery fire and the Air Force and the whole of the corps artillery and divisional artillery, army artillery.
They were efficient weapons. They didn't have any efficient weapons, or didn't have any peculiarities that might cause them to fail. Or
what, the mortar? Mm-hmm. Marvellous weapon. No. They weren't always as accurate as they might be, but a good mortar platoon would put down a very, very successful strike on the enemy the other side.
Anti-tank weapons, you would have an anti-tank platoon.
You're getting me into deep water now, my memory now is. I think we had the old 6-pounder anti-tank weapon. I'd have to look these up, the details you've got before. But they were a platoon, again, I think we had 8 anti-tank guns. And I can illustrate later on when I talk about perhaps the Battle of Rangers, how they were used. But they were brought up in the attack as soon as you possibly could to consolidate a position. And there were ways of using them, either in enfilade or the wrong way, which I did once, was to shooting down a road instead of getting them enfilade and things. But I could illustrate that later on. But they were they played their part, the anti-tank, very well, if they were used properly.
Had wireless or radio communication improved? Had it become more efficient as more years went on?
Yes.
In what ways?
I think that they were much more reliable, and we had a slightly longer range with the company wireless sets. And we relied, and we became much more wireless-minded, which before the war, we really didn't. I mean, I don't think I ever operated a wireless set hardly before the war. And then when I joined the 50 Div, I mean, I controlled the battalion practically on the radio. I was on the radio the whole time, and even more so when we moved out of 50 Div, when they disbanded 50 Div and they took my battalion in the 7th Army Division. We were absolutely reliant on the communications, and we not only used our own communications, but we were in close touch with the armored regiment which we used, and we used their communications as well, and we became completely communication conscious. And there were only various times I can remember when things went wrong. One particular battle, I can remember when we relied on one gunner's 88 set, which was sort of portable thing that you have now to take from your car, you know. And we really did become communication conscious, and my goodness, it was important.
Were there any other specialist units within a battalion or company situation which...
Pioneers?
Yes, pioneers.
They were the chaps who did the sort of minor Royal Engineering work, and they could build a bridge if it had to. They could help you in laying mines. They were experts at that, or even taking up mines, German mines. And they were expert in the use of explosives. And they were also used as protection in certain cases of the platoon at battalion headquarters. Some battalions had a defense platoon, but I was used to use our pioneers, who were splendid characters, when they weren't using, when doing other jobs. When we were going forward, it wasn't quite so necessary, because then they were probably taking up mines and that sort of thing. But if you wanted to blow up a house or blow up a bridge or that sort of thing, sappers knew all about explosives and things.
In your training in the years coming up to joining the 9th Battalion, how much had been with supporting arms such as the RAF?
Well, there again, not a great deal, except that when my battle school, we obviously brought it in as how you could use the RAF. But I found that in Normandy, I had an RAF officer with me as a commanding officer. And that was absolutely marvellous. And they had sort of a thing which was called a cab rank, which was aircraft which were flying around up top. And they had these typhoons with shot rockets off. And they were the most terrifying sight. They didn't always sort of make quite sure the boundary was quite correct between your forward troops and the enemy. But on the other hand, they were marvellous. And you could say to the RAF officer, look, our tanks have failed to move that thing over there. Can you see in the wood there? There's two or three German anti-tank guns there. We can't get at it at the moment. Can you put something down on it? And he would just get onto his radio, call up the old typhoon, and point out, can you see that particular building there? We'll go 3 days left. You'll find some tanks there. Brass them up. And they were suddenly boom down. And that was marvelous. That was real cooperation between the army and the RAF. And, of course, the trouble is we lose a bit of that. We lose the lessons of the war in years of peace. I just wonder how tight they are now on that sort of thing.
Had this, in effect, been worked out in theory, but it didn't actually happen until you were in
action?
Yeah,
absolutely.
So it worked extraordinarily well.
Although, I was trying to think, after the war, when I was commandant at School of Infantry, we used to do a lot of demonstrations in front of all sorts of senior people. And the great thing was to get as close as you could within the safety rules to the artillery shells, and you walk up behind it, whether it was a barrage or whether it was firing at artillery targets which have already been earmarked. And you also had the Air Force. But the trouble with safety regulations, too, you had to be so careful that it wasn't really realistic because you had too much of a gap between them before. During the war, we used to do these training exercises with the gunners and with the Air Force and walk very close up behind it. In the Northern Ireland, we did that. And I can remember being within about sort of 30 yards of the shells in front of you. It wasn't all that happy. You never quite know when one was going to drop short, and they did occasionally.
I was going to ask you about artillery support, actually. What kind of support would you be asking for and getting from the artillery?
Well, if it was a defensive position you were in, you had your own gunner with you. If you were a commanding officer, you had your own gunner, and you had younger gunner officers as observation post, OP officers, or forward observation officers. And with your gunner, who'd be a battery commander, major, or second commander of the battery, you would have, in a defensive position, artillery targets marked and with a code name on them, which he would just shout down the blower and say, put down Delta or Beta or Alpha or whatever it was. And in attack, you would work out with your gunner, on probably on a time program, various targets, and you try and keep to the time, and you cross all related to the start time, start line, when you get across the zero or across the start line, and then you would have a timed gunner program, and you'd work that out on the pace that the infantry are likely to go, and then you'd take on various targets of the enemy as you go through, and if there was a bit of a hold up, then you could repeat that. But either you had your own artillery regiment, or if it was an important attack, then you might even have all the divisional artillery and the corps artillery and even the army artillery and the heavy artillery and the whole lot come in and all combined on a combined artillery program. And that was the job of the gunners in conjunction with the targets that you said you wanted taken out. It would all be worked on a time program. So it was very important that you crossed the start line at the right time and you kept up to the time program. Otherwise, you'd find that you'd get away from you and people would come to life again and that would be a mistake. And so it was with practice, it's quite extraordinary how the things seemed to work, and that's what you needed, you see. And training was the whole thing, training. And even when there was a muddle, if you went back to the principles of your training, that's the thing. That
in what way had the artillery weapons changed, and which kind of weapons were
25 pounder? I think it was practically we used the whole time.
And then there was this was a good gun, wasn't it?
That was a very good gun. Yep, we had the whole time through. And they had the sort of mountain guns too, which we didn't use in Normandy, but I mean they did in Burma and in Norway. But the 25 pounder was a great gun in the desert. And the other thing which we learned to do, you see, in Northern Ireland too, and was the actual cooperation with tanks. And the way you either did it, I mean, if it was mostly an infantry target in front of you, you tried to encourage the tanks to go ahead. If, on the other hand, there were anti-tank guns and SP guns, you had your tanks probably off to the flanks and shooting you in with the infantry going up through the middle. And there again, training with the actual guys who were going to do it, and you all knew them by their Christian names, the thing worked as a team. And that was, if you could get that, it was your goal, to work as a team, and everybody knew what they were supposed to be doing the whole time. And right the way down the line, it was tremendously important that every single soldier knew what the plan was. It gave great confidence. If you don't, you get into a muddle and people don't know what they're doing, then you're in trouble.
So this was really a great change from the First World War, in the sense that right down to the lowest private,
absolutely,
they knew exactly.
I used to make it absolutely vital, because it's very difficult to ever talk to the whole battalion together, but my main thing was commanding officers, when we had a plan of attack to do that, is to wander around the companies and say, now, what you know what you're on, don't you? And they'd say, well, I don't know, sir. I said, right, this is what we're on. And it made it tremendously important that the officers passed it on down the rail, all the way down. Everybody wanted to know exactly what the plan was.
As the months and the years go over, General, and it's obvious that an invasion is going to have to come. Mm. In what aspects of training was coming into this in a sporting role?
Yeah, when we'd recovered from the effect of Dunkirk and defending England with one rifle, we, as the equipment came forward and as the obvious need to be trained for the combined operations of going across, most officers did quite a lot of training in getting in and out of landing craft when landing craft were ready. And I remember going to a sort of commando course up at Inverary, which was fairly tough and involved an awful lot of marching over moors and things, but also getting into the lock there, into landing craft, and going across the lock, and then landing out of landing craft. And so there was quite a lot of that went on. And indeed, we didn't do it, but there were any amount learning how to throw themselves out of aeroplanes, parachuting, and others who were learning to get into gliders and do landings from gliders, which all paid its dividend later on when we did the crossing and the parachutists landed and the airborne division landed in gliders around Pegasus Bridge and all those sort of things. And so there was all that combined training started and was going flat out by the time that we had the kit to do it. And that was all the question, was the restrictions were on having the kit to do it. And I think that when Monty and Eisenhower decided that we were well trained enough to do all this, they decided then perhaps June 1944 was the time to do this.
We haven't mentioned the Americans, actually, and obviously they were pouring into the country after December, what it was, 1941.
Yes.
What relationships were being struck up between the British?
The thing is, I hardly ever saw any Americans until actually D-Day. On D-Day, certainly. I mean, I could tell you about that when we go across, but we hardly saw the Americans. I think they were, we were never within reach, except perhaps it might have been the odd big exercises called bumper exercises, which were using about three or four divisions around by a sort of plane. There was certainly an American element of taking part. And it could be there would be one or two sort of hefty old clashes between them, if they were being used as enemy or not, I don't know. No, I don't really see, I didn't see a great deal of them. I think on the whole they kept themselves a bit to themselves, and quite rightly in a way, I think so.
Coming up towards the time that you went to the 9th Battalion, were you seeing anything of the higher officers, the generals? And
we used to be continually taken off to hear Monty talk, and he was great. Horrocks, General Horrocks, who was the corps commander, he was a brilliant speaker. Eisenhower came down to see 9DLI about 2 days before we took off. He was extremely popular. Monty wasn't so popular with the DLI to start with. I mean, because the DLI had been through practically every single phase of the battle, from right the way through the desert into Sicily, into Italy, and then to suddenly be plucked out by Monty, because he wanted to have experienced soldiers and mix them with perhaps some who weren't so battle experienced. So his plan was to bring some of the desert warriors back and then put in chaps like myself, full of enthusiasm, didn't know how dangerous it bloody well was, and to sort of stir them up a bit. And when Monty came down to talk to us, he got a bit of a boo from some of the over 50 day people, because they thought they'd done their bit. And we come to the end.
Before we move on to your being with the 9th DLI General, can we just switch over briefly to Dunkirk time? The disaster, or whatever you want to call it, medical disaster of Dunkirk, what effect had this upon you personally?
Well, I think it was obviously morale sank considerably over this. I mean, all disastrous stories that there were. And, of course, we saw a lot of the soldiers coming back through Southampton, looking a bit dejected and disheveled. And yet the irrepressible British soldiers' sense of humour, they somehow or other made a bit of a joke about something or other, and that always cheered you up slightly. And I think, my thoughts were then, I think it made us even more determined. Probably, whatever happened, they weren't going to get into this damn country anyhow. And so therefore we must do our bit even more. And the trouble was we were hands were tied behind our backs. We had practically no equipment then other than rifles. And nothing like carriers or anything like that then. And so we were slightly restricted. And certainly you were quite right. I mean, there was a demoralization factor. But I don't know what it is. When the British soldier is really at his lowest, it's probably when he's at his best. And I always found the Geordies were like that. I mean, the worse the situation was, the more they reacted. And if you could tell them it was going to be bad, and it was slightly better, you won a trick. But I find the British soldier, when he's really down, like in Burma and everywhere else, I mean, when they're down, they'll work absolutely flat out to get on top again.
Was this mood reflected amongst the civilians, do you recall?
Yeah, I think so, because although we were down the south coast then, Southampton, certainly, I mean, you only want to look at the people in London when they've been bombed. I mean, the morale of the people who have been bombed in London, and old Winston going round and chatting them up, and the old Cockney.